Great to have you with us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we take a look at the world of wildlife here in the state of Wisconsin. David Drake and Jamie Knack will be with us, and we'll talk about everything under the sun relating to our state's wildlife. But to begin with, we have some sad news to share today. I know a lot of you enjoyed our programs with Dave Riddell. Dave was a bat ecologist with the Department of Natural Resources. He was on the program maybe 3 weeks ago, I think, somewhere around there. Sorry to say that Dave passed away Monday, had a long battle with cancer, and he's certainly going to be missed by his friends and family and colleagues. Certainly anybody who cares about Wisconsin wildlife is going to miss Dave. Our regular wildlife guest, Scott Craven, was Dave's advisor, and Scott agreed to stop by today. He worked closely with Dave and here to share some reflections on Dave's work. And Scott, thanks for coming by today. Appreciate it very much.
Well, you're certainly welcome, Larry. I wish I was here under better circumstances, and
yeah,
usually am at the first of the month, but I first met Dave as an undergraduate back in the mid-1990s. He was a student in my vertebrate ecology class, an excellent student, and he was keenly interested in the section that we always had in the class on bats. And he later credited that exposure to bats with his career choice, which I always took as a wonderful compliment.
Yeah. But,
he left after graduation with his undergraduate degree, but returned a few years later with an interest in a master's degree working with bats, and that all came together very nicely, and he ended up working up at the Nita Mine, a very important bat hibernaculum just east of Horicon Marsh, where he worked on general bat ecology, their interaction with the wind power development system there with wind turbines, and he developed an ingenious photo counter device that allowed for remote counting of the bats as they came and went from that hibernaculum, which was an interesting new development in that. After that work, when he had received his master's degree, he went on to be hired by the DNR as their first bat ecologist, and I guess I'd have to say that he seized that opportunity, to say the least.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was his dream. He became a spokesperson and a champion for a group of animals that were very much in need of attention, and that was a very good thing. Some of the things that I think about when I think about Dave's accomplishments are the terrific team that he built around him at the DNR, and thankfully, and for the bats' benefit, those folks are still in place and will carry on Dave's work. He was known for the bat survey work that he did in terms of helping figure out where the bats are in Wisconsin and how many there are. He was a strong believer in bat education. He and his team brought the Bat Fest here to Madison area as a spring event, and it still is, and hopefully will remain a big spring event. As you mentioned, he was a guest here on the program. And bat night at our summer field course up at Kemp Station in northern Wisconsin is always one of the highlights for the students every other year when Dave would come up with his team and they'd capture bats and mark bats and chase bats around. And it was just a great experience for the undergrads, and he really enjoyed doing it. He was also responsible for a new suite of bat regulations that are now in place, and in part in preparation for probably the inevitable arrival of the much-dreaded white nose syndrome. I think Wisconsin's as well-positioned as it could possibly be to minimize, to the extent possible, the impact of that disease, largely through the work of Dave and his team. And he personally established an endowment fund for bat conservation, which will live on and provide support for bat conservation, hopefully well into the future. And I guess finally, I just say, and I think we mentioned this on the program the last time I was on, that U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service representatives traveled to Wisconsin just a few weeks ago to present Dave with their Silver Eagle Award for his career accomplishments and efforts in conservation. And unfortunately, at 42, he was taken from his friends and colleagues and his bats way too soon.
It's too bad. Although he did manage to beat the forecast, he was told that he wouldn't make it through the weekend, and I think he just stubbornly decided to live at least until Monday. He was a wonderful man, and Scott, thanks for coming by and talking about
You're welcome. I do, before I leave, I do need to clear up one, but we don't want to leave any misinformation on the table. And on the last program, we had a Facebook photograph of a woodpecker on the side of a tree. And we danced around it a little bit. So, oh, there's some partial albinism there, and couldn't come up with a good explanation. When in fact, I did a little checking when I got back and looked at some photographs. It was a juvenile red-headed woodpecker in perfectly normal plumage for that particular bird. So we've cleared that up. So David and Jamie are all yours.
Thanks, Scott. Thank you so much. Scott Craven, a wildlife ecologist. And he's by the first Wednesday of every month, and we'll have him back again. But I was really pleased that he would be willing to come over and say a few words about Dave Riddell. Dave Riddell was a wonderful man. Sorry, condolences to his wife and family. He was a great guy. And David Drake and Jamie Knack are with us, and they're carrying on. They're committed as well to our state's wildlife, just like Scott is, just like Dave Riddell was. David Drake is wildlife specialist with UW Extension, associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology. And David, great to see you again.
Well, thank you for having me on again, Larry.
Appreciate it very much. And Jamie Knack, wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Jamie, thank you for coming by.
Thanks for having us. It's great to be here.
Well, it helps. Always works better if I turn your microphone on. But now I have your microphone on. I know Dave told me to kind of keep your side part of it down today, but I didn't really want to do it.
I want my money back, Larry.
Oh, my gosh. Well, here we are. And speaking of Dave Riddell, I know there are some bat species that are fattening up now for moving south.
There are. We have got, we really have 8 bat species in Wisconsin, but for all intents and purposes, we're down to 7 because the one federally endangered Indiana bat has not been seen in Wisconsin since probably the early 1960s or so. And even if it was here, it would only frequent or inhabit the lower southern part of the state. So we have roughly 7, we do have 7 bat species in Wisconsin. 3 of those bat species migrate out of our area, so they're active year-round, and those are the eastern red bat, the hoary bat, and the silver-haired bat. And those bats are probably well on their way south already. We've done some research in my lab where we look at bat activity around wind farms, and the peak of bat activity a lot of times is last third and fourth week of August and first or so week of September. So that's kind of the peak of when they start moving out. And then we've got 4 bat species, the little brown, big brown, eastern pipistrelle, and the northern myotis, that are resident bats, and they stay here year-round, but because they're here in the wintertime when no insects are, and bats obviously are insectivores, that their strategy is to hibernate. So they are also fattening up so that they can put on enough fat reserves and make it through the winter hibernation.
And I should, Dave, just one more note about Dave Riddell. We have a note about Dave was up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and we've with a link to today's article, and we've archived a program from June that we did with David. So if you want to hear Dave Riddell again, we've got it up on my Facebook page. So just to mention that. Well, the bats aren't the only ones that are fattening up to head south, Jamie.
Yeah, there's a lot of birds migrating right now as well. The fall warblers are certainly coming through. Hummingbirds, I've still seen hummingbirds at our feeder very frequently. Orioles are moving through, grosbeaks. Lots of ducks, geese are starting to make the push with the colder temperatures and winds. So now's not the time to stop feeding those birds if you have been over the summer. Keep supplying a water source and the food that you have been supplying previously or throughout the summer. So hummingbird feeders, the nectar for the orioles, keep it out there. You can still enjoy them for a few more weeks here before they do finish their migrations.
And the watering is kind of cool. You know, our bird baths are, you've got bees of all sorts, stripes using it. You've got the squirrel will come up and take a take a drink out of it. The birds are coming to it. It's fun.
Especially this year since we've been so dry that I think, you know, we've gotten a lot of reports of, I think, increased interactions between humans and wildlife, and a lot of wildlife moving into people's yards. I think a lot of that is reason because people are watering and have water outstanding that animals are in desperate need of this dry summer.
Yeah, absolutely. We had a new lawn that we really had to water, and boy, the robins, the robins, and well, the other birds too would just be there, and just reveling in that water as it came down.
I was just going to say, one other thing we should note, just for all the listeners out there, is this is also the time that the animals that are sticking around for the winter are also looking for nice, warm, dry places for the winter. So things like mice and some of the resident bats and other animals like that, if they have the chance to get into your house or your buildings, they will do that because that provides a very nice, warm place for the winter. So make sure that you keep your doors and windows sealed tightly and that you seal cracks around your foundation and your eaves and things like that, and that will help prevent unwanted overwinter visitors.
David Drake and Jamie Knack, our guests today from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. What kinds of wildlife have you been noticing lately, and what are they up to? Are you a hunter? We talk about the hunting seasons as well. If you have a question or comment, I hope you'll join us. I haven't given the number yet, so let me do it right now. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post a photo and question on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. And let's see here. We've got some photos. I'll have to look into this a little bit more. Help, a friend. Here's a photo from Marge. A friend sent me this photo to identify, taken in the apple orchard of Chippewa Falls. Said the critter was walnut-sized. So I looked online, typing in all the pertinent descriptions. Long tail, if you can see it. Long tail, a white hind feet are a match for the meadow jumping mouse, but the ears and face aren't an exact match. Is this indeed a meadow jumping mouse without the long tail? To me, the body, face, and color would look so much like a type of vole.
From the picture we've got up on the Facebook page, it certainly looks like a jumping mouse, and we've got two species of jumping mice in Wisconsin. Both of them are native species. One's the meadow jumping mouse, and the other's the woodland jumping mouse. That certainly looks like a meadow jumping mouse. Because of that long tail is a good, 2.5-3 times the length of the body, for one thing. So that's a dead giveaway. You can also look at those large hind feet and legs there.
Yeah, big, long feet.
That look like a kangaroo leg almost. And that allows them to actually jump, and they can jump a pretty good distance, about 3 feet or so. From the looks of it, it's a little bit hard to tell from the body, but typically woodland jumping mice have a little bit of a darker stripe down the middle of their back. So, and the description of apple orchard, apple orchards have a lot of grassy meadow around them and things like that. So it certainly does fit the description and the photographic description as well of a meadow jumping mouse. And that's a pretty neat thing to see. They're not, they're relatively common. They're not seen awful a lot because they're relatively small and they're somewhat secretive. So that's a nice find.
That's a great photo. If you're near your computer, take a look. Go online to the Larry Mueller Show. He's got a great photo there of that meadow jumping mouse. David Drake and Jamie Knack from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Our guests, I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at the status of our Wisconsin wildlife today with David Drake and Jamie Knack of the UW-Madison Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening in. Lots of callers online now, so I think we should go to the phones. Anne in Thiensville up first. Anne, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I came across a snapping turtle this summer, and so I started talking to people about it, and somebody said to me that there is commercial harvesting of snapping turtles in Wisconsin that are going to the China market. And I just wondered what the status of that is.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah, I've not heard of the commercial side of things. It may very well be that they can be harvested commercially, but there's an easy source to find this information, and David and I don't have it with us, but the Department of Natural Resources does have an amphibian and reptile regulation booklet or brochure that outlines the regulations, the seasons. There is a carapace size or a shell size minimum and maximum for harvesting snapping turtles. There's daily bag limits, and as I said, a specific season when they can be harvested so that they're not being harvested during the breeding season as well. So if you go to the Department of Natural Resources website and do a search for reptile regulations, you'll come up with it, and that will outline what regulations are in place. But I have not heard anything about the commercial side of that. This is really on an individual level, much like a hunting regulation or a fishing regulation, but that mm-hmm. turtles can be harvested, and they are, I'm told, fairly good table fare.
Yep. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Ann, for calling. Appreciate it. Yeah, I've had snapping turtle soup. It's pretty good. Pretty good. Jeff in Cedarburg, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I got another turtle question for you.
Okay.
I live in Cedarburg, obviously, and I saw a very large turtle, and I looked it up. It had just a tremendous amount of character in its shell, very texturous. And it was about 18 inches long, the shell, by 13 inches wide and about 9 inches thick. And the only thing I could find online that looked like it was a wood turtle, but it said they only got to 9 inches. So I'm curious as to what kind of turtle that was.
Well, without a picture, we may not get 100% identification here, but can you describe the type of habitat that you found the turtle in?
Right on Cedar Creek.
On Cedar Creek. So the wood turtle is one of our threatened species of turtles. There's 12 turtle species in the state. 5 of those are threatened or endangered, the wood turtle being one that is threatened. However, their populations in areas can be, you know, relatively common in a local area. So it's not uncommon to see a wood turtle or a Blanding's turtle, but their populations are being monitored closely. The wood turtle's shell is pretty distinctive in that it looks like somebody carved that shell out of a block of wood. They're very, very pretty and have, you know, great detail in them. Much like a painted turtle, you know, maximum size, I think the wood turtle probably fits that category too in terms of their, you know, of their size. So mm-hmm. the only other thing you could maybe mistake it for would be a snapping turtle, which has a really large head. Looks very prehistoric looking, pretty obvious just by looking at the head of the animal. And then also a soft-shell turtle, they can get very large too. And those two species are so distinctive in themselves that it would be difficult to have a case of mistaken identity there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I took several pictures. I can send them to you. I'm not real good with the internet stuff, but I'll try.
Try, put it up on our, yeah, see if you can put it up on our Facebook page, because then we can give you an identification right off the bat.
Yep, we can do it while we're on the show yet, or if you can't do that, you can email one of us after the fact, and we'll get back to you. Be happy to do that.
Mm-hmm. But now you got my interest, so please, yeah. if you can, get it up on the Facebook page.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I'm just surprised how big it was. I didn't know that they got that, or it didn't sound like they ever got that big, so I was wondering what.
Oh.
I mean, it's huge, you know?
Cool.
All right, I'll send you pictures as soon as I can here.
Thanks a lot for calling, Jeff. Appreciate it. And, let's see, you can join in too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions or comments. Let's go to Chris in Menominee Falls. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
My question is, I just wonder, and I can't find this information anywhere, where do hummingbird moths, kind of a hawk moth, where do they go in the winter? I haven't seen him for a couple of days now. And I realize they lay eggs and then, you know, the new ones come out next spring. But do they migrate or do they just die?
What do you think, David Drake?
Well, Chris, the silence you hear is no knowledge on the question. I don't know, to tell you the truth. I would perhaps recommend that you email Phil Pelletieri on campus here, or I know Phil's a regular guest with Larry. And if you can get back on when Phil's on, I guess, next month.
Yeah.
Call him back, but Phil would certainly have the answer to that question.
Okay.
Sorry we can't help you there, but Chris, but thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Facebook question from Buzz, or his comment, we've seen a lot more woodpeckers at our feeders this summer, redheaded, downy, occasional pileated, or pileated, if you want to pronounce it that way. Any reason for the influx? I've seen more, too, this year, actually, at my feeders.
You know, I think it gets back to that issue that it's been an unusual weather year this summer with the dry and drought conditions and extremely hot conditions. And You know, I think a lot of animals have moved into areas where humans occupy because there's artificial habitat available, yeah. Food, water, things like that. And I certainly have not done any survey of the insect population this year, but I know that there were a lack of mosquitoes, which was wonderful, and things like that. And it just may very well be that the natural food source of woodpeckers, which are the insects and things like that, that maybe they were not as abundant as normal, and there was an easy meal at your feeder or around your house, and because you're watering, or there's something else going on there that was providing better insect habitat, and therefore there was a more abundant insect population around your house.
Email from Erica in Oconomowoc, who says, I saw, this is near Devil's Lake, she says, I saw a wolf and a red fox and lots of deer and turkeys near our home. Okay, so she saw a wolf near Devil's Lake and red fox and lots of deer and turkeys near Oconomowoc. Are my eyes getting sharper, or was this a good year for wildlife? And just kind of what you were talking about, Jamie, next?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think in many cases, it's just a matter of being in the right place at the right time and being able to see some of these wildlife encounters as you're driving or out and about in the country. I've seen red fox this year. Probably more than I have in the past, but that's been two or three individual animals and just happened to be in the right place at the right time. So as far as the wolves, they are starting to move into the southern part of the state. So that is certainly a possibility that was a wolf near Devil's Lake. I haven't looked or talked recently or looked into that area recently in terms of what's been sighted for wolves, but that is certainly a possibility. And as David mentioned, just with the weather conditions, it does seem like there's more deer out on the landscape, but are there really more deer, or is it that they're more visible? And with the drought that we had, David and I received a lot of calls about deer in people's backyards and causing, or browsing on ornamental plants and causing more problem than usual. And that probably has something to do with the drought conditions, especially in the forest, and they're moving out to look for alternative food sources.
Jackie in Drummond will give you a chance now. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, yeah. Every year for the bear season, I always just get upset, and I really shouldn't. But I'll start this out. I saw my local grocery store poster from the DNR. It says, don't feed the bears, watch your bear feeders. And then we allow baiting for bear hunting. So this is such a dichotomy. Doesn't this create... garbage bears when you're feeding the bears, and you can bait them all along, and then the DNR tells you not to feed the bears. And also, I would like a history of using dogs in bear baiting, because I know a lot of states do not have this. One more question. People said that a lot of the bear licenses are issued to people from the South who have hound dogs and coon dogs who hunt. So if you could answer those questions, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yep, thanks for calling. Just on the license thing, I could even respond to that one, because I don't think the license is, it's always a sort of a random draw on the licenses. And there is some basis in terms of your, how many times you've applied.
The way the bear season framework is handled is that if you are interested in receiving a bear hunting license, you pay the application fee and you receive a preference point. And right now, depending on the hunting zone that you're hunting in, it could take 8 years or more to draw a permit. So what that means is there's more interest in hunting bears. There's more individuals interested in hunting bears than the quota is going to allow for. So not everybody can get a license to hunt a bear every year, but you gain preference points by applying every year. And once, you've reached a certain level of putting in, you'll eventually receive a license to pursue bear in a given zone. Your questions or observations about baiting for bear, but then having the state have prohibitions on feeding bears around the house. Well, the reason the state doesn't allow you to feed bears around the house is because they do become habituated to humans, become habituated to the yard. We spend a lot of time recommending that people, especially in the north, do not feed birds right as the bears are coming out of hibernation, because they are looking for easy food sources. And there's a lot of native plants and and food sources that aren't on the landscape right away in the spring. So they look for easy pickings, whether that's somebody's garbage that they've left out, dog food that's been left out in the yard, bird feeders that are accessible to them. So the reason baiting or feeding for bear is not allowed is because of a human interaction and to reduce those conflicts. And oftentimes what happens if they are habituated, USDA Wildlife Services gets called in to remove that bear. And in some cases, that bear is euthanized. Sometimes it's relocated, depending on the situation and the severity of the problem. Using bait or placing bait for bear hunting purposes, in Wisconsin, you're correct. We have two options. Actually, there's more options besides that, but you can use dogs to pursue bear, and you can also bait place bait in order to attract bears for the purpose of hunting them. Some states have both, some have neither, some have one or the other, but in Wisconsin we do have both options on the plate. Without those options, it is difficult to harvest the number of bears that we're looking at harvesting in a given year. So those techniques or tools that are available to hunters become important in meeting our harvest goals. And the other thing to keep in mind with baiting is that it's a short period of time during the hunting season where bait can be placed on the landscape. And there are regulations in terms of how that bait is to be placed and what the quantity of bait that can be used at those sites as well. So there's regulations governing that within the bear hunting regulations.
All right. Thanks very much for those questions. Appreciate it, Dee in Waukesha. Let's turn to you next. Hi, Dee.
Hi. Thanks for the show. Thanks to your guests today. I have a fairly mundane question that's probably asked a lot, but hopefully worth repeating. Is there any magic trick to separating feeding squirrels and feeding birds in your backyard without the squirrels sort of gobbling up all of the bird food?
Mm-hmm.
And I have a second question if you have time.
Okay. I have a bird feeder I think I paid $120 for. I have two of them that when the birds land on them, the feed holes stay open. But if something heavy like a squirrel lands, sets on them, he pulls down, essentially the perch pulls down and that blocks the feeding holes.
Does it work?
The baffle feeder.
Yeah, it's a baffle feeder. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they work off of counterweights, and oftentimes they're made out of metal material.
Yeah, made out of metal, yeah.
So they're kind of chew-proof for the squirrels as well. So that can they're pricey, but in the long run,
run, they're great. So
okay, thank you.
A place like Wild Birds Unlimited. I think I bought both mine. I bought one, and then it worked so well, I went and bought another one.
A couple other things, Dee, you may want to try is one replacing your sunflower seed with safflower seed. And safflower is a white seed. It's eaten by the same types of birds that would eat your sunflower seed, but safflower has more of a bitter taste to it, and some squirrels avoid that seed because of that bitter taste.
Oh,
so you could
great.
Try that. And then
that's
there are some
good one.
There are some pretty creative attempts at keeping
yeah,
squirrels
I see
off your feeders.
Down my street.
My favorite one is to string a line between, for example, two trees or posts or something like that, and then hang your feeders off that increments off that line, and in between each feeder, take some PVC pipe and string that line through the PVC pipe. So essentially, you've got segments of PVC pipe separating each feeder. And the idea is, as the squirrel runs across that line to get to the feeder, it hits the PVC pipe, which is a larger diameter than the string or line, and the PVC pipe spins, which then spins the squirrel off of there. So it is can be very entertaining to watch the squirrel try to run this tightrope. But in order for that to be effective, your feeders have to be at least 4 feet off the ground and at least 8 feet from any tree limb or roof, because squirrels can either jump up off the ground or off of an elevated perch to get to your feeder.
Yeah, just a quick comment. We get amazed sometimes at the acrobatics of the squirrels. We have one, we've tried lengthening the chain to longer than the body length of the squirrel from the branch it's hanging from, and they literally grab on with their tippy toes and hang upside down to get the food out of the feeder. They're amazing.
they can make you very frustrated, yeah. Also, because they can outsmart just about anything you do sometimes.
But those counterweight Those counterweight feeders work.
I think the tip about the saffron seed is great, too. That was something
I
was looking for.
Very good tip. Very good tip.
My second question, very brief, and thank you, Alice, for I love this program. The second question I have is safe removal of wasps. We have a couple of nests under our shutters and one in our shed. When's the best time to start taking them out?
Not too long from now. They'll be dead, won't they? Jamie?
Yeah, that's the case. But also, I mean, if it's a hazard right now, buying a can of wasp spray from a local hardware store and just going in the evening when they tend to be more dormant, not as active, and at night spraying that nest and then just giving them a time to die, and then you can go in and pull it off. So we've been doing that with some of the small wasp nests around the house throughout the summer. So,
you know, my question is, though, my husband, I fear for his safety. He's breathed in so much wasp spray trying to get rid of these things, and they seem so prolific this year. We'd spray one and the nest would be back in a few days. Is there anything else we can do?
I think that's your best option, and just be very persistent about it.
Okay.
And maybe, there are some of these paper masks you can buy at some hardware stores that your husband could wear.
Well, I was kind of joking. But...
Ah, gotcha.
Well, okay, well, wait another month and they'll be gone.
For sure.
That's right.
Thank you very much.
Yep. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Jamie Nack and David Drake, our guests here, and they come up with a quiz. We should get this quiz going here. I like this quiz. They have a great idea. We're going to pick a winner at random from all the correct answers, and that person will receive a copy of a cool new book. It's called Bird Sense, What It's Like to Be a Bird by Tim Burkhead. So you're going to email your answer to talk@WPR.org. Please put quiz in the subject line. So talk@WPR.org, that's your email. Put quiz in the subject line. Also include your first and last name and where you live in the message. You can also call 1-800-642-1234 with your answer. 1-800-642-1234. You may run into busy phone lines. Here's the question. Now, it's identifying a bird sound. And what I want you to do is listen and identify by common name the bird that makes this sound. Let's give it. Hopefully, we've got it all set up here. Let's give it a try. Maybe that last little would be
perhaps.
Could be a little bit of a giveaway. So you've got 10 minutes to get your answers in. And again, identify that by common name, the bird that makes that sound. And we'll send you we'll probably, if we get correct answers, I'm sure we will, we'll draw names out of a hat, essentially, electronically. And the winner will receive a copy of Bird Sense, What It's Like to Be a Bird by Tim Burkhead. I'm going to play this once more just for people. Let's listen to it one more time. See if you can recognize this bird. Ah.
And then we have 400 birds roughly in the state of Wisconsin, so you've got a 1 in 400 chance.
All right. You know, we get... Noel Cutright's wife sent us some information on the hummingbird moth information. Hummingbird moths have, somebody asked about that earlier. They have a flight period of about 6 weeks. That's at max. Then they die. They overwinter is as pupa. So there we go. We now know.
And you know, Noel Cutright is probably one of Wisconsin's premier birders. So if his wife is anything like he is, she may be emailing in very quickly with the correct answer to that bird call.
Oh yeah, she'll know that. I've met Noel and his wife, and they're really cool people. And Noel, of course, is a guest on this program pretty much every holiday. He comes on. So Ah, that's great to hear from her. And Norman in Wausau, thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning. I have a question and a comment. The
okay.
question is, the last 2 weeks, we've been hearing what I'm sure are bard owls just at dusk, that ooh-hoo, ooh-hoo. And there's a whole bunch of them. We live just north of the city of Wausau, and we're in a wooded area, and they've been within 100 feet of the house. And the other night, we had about three to the north and at least a half a dozen to the south. Now, the question about this is, why are they calling at this time of the year, and why are there so many? Now, it's not every night that they're doing this. The other night, they were here again, but not in as many numbers.
Okay. David, you and Drake, you want to take that?
I sure will. Well, the reason they are calling right now is because they're starting to mate. And owls are, especially great horned owls and barred owls, are one of the earliest nesting bird species we have in the state of Wisconsin. And they can start nesting and laying eggs as early as late January. So they're starting to call because they're starting to establish territory, looking for mates and things like that. And my guess is that you probably have had as many barred owls as you hear now that they are around your house year-round. You just may not be aware of it because they're not calling at other times of the year when they're not trying to defend territory or attract a mate.
There you go.
And my comment is on these squirrel feeders, bird feeders to exclude squirrels. We have a very inexpensive one. I drove, I think it was a 1 inch or inch and a quarter pipe about 2 feet long into the ground. And then I took about a 7 foot section of EMT pipe and put that inside of it. And I put a collar, which you can buy at any of the farm stores or the bird places, that you put on about a foot below your feeder. And that collar can tip. It's probably extends about 8 inches out or 10 inches out from the pole itself. And there's a little collar, sets collar underneath it to hold it there, but it can tip a little bit. And then I got a long feeder that holds a couple pounds of sunflower seed, and it's got a hole in the middle, and I just put it on the top of that EMT pipe, and it works slicker than a whistle. Because although they can climb up this one-inch pipe, believe it or not, when they get to that collar, they got a problem because they have to jump out to get onto the collar, and it tips. And generally just knocks them down. We have not had a successful squirrel getting in the feeder. However, like it was said previously, you can't have overhanging trees or anything because they'll drop down on it from that.
Yep.
But if it's out in the open, it works perfect. That doesn't cost you, but maybe, oh, gosh.
A few bucks for a pipe.
Yep.
Yeah. Norm, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Norman from Wausau. That's pretty cool. We're talking wildlife, everything wildlife today. If the open line, you can get you on at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Or if you've got a photo or a question, you can post it on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Love to see that as well as we visit with our guests, David Drake and Jamie Knack from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Wisconsin. Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network as we talk the world of wildlife with our guests, David Drake and Jamie Knack from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Great to have them along here today, and thank you for listening in. And a little clarification on from a Facebook clarification from Tim. A caller was calling about all these people from the south hunting, and the caller's Tim says that caller was confusing bear hunting licenses with training for bear hounds. Lots of out-of-state people come to Wisconsin to train their hounds because Wisconsin allows a long training session in the summer.
Yeah, and what Tim's talking about is that you need a hunting license, so you go through that permit process for a number of years before you're finally drawn for a permit to harvest a bear. That is one license then that you have to purchase. But if you are going to be involved in the pursuit or the hunting opportunity, so if a father was going and his son was going, the person who is participating but did not hold the license to harvest the bear, they still need a permit to be part of the chase or the hunt. As far as the numbers from out-of-state people who come into Wisconsin and enjoy that opportunity, I don't have numbers in front of me here, but those numbers should be available through the Department of Natural Resources licensing division. They should be able to call those numbers up in terms of how many non-hunting licenses were sold and how many pursuit licenses were sold to out-of-state hunters. And we can talk about that later if we get into the updates on the wolf hunt when we talk about out-of-state and in-state hunters. So,
Larry, we should maybe fill in your callers a little bit with some more information. And Jamie's mm-hmm. too modest to say this, but she shot a bear last year, and she's a very good hunter in general, mm-hmm. but she's an expert bear hunter and has become very passionate about this. So that's one of the reasons she knows so much about this.
If the I don't know about expert, but I have had the opportunity to draw a hunting tag three times in my lifetime and have purposefully hunted over bait and with dogs, because I do often get these questions and the questions of ethics involved in those different opportunities or methods for hunting bear. So that's been important for me to participate in order to be able to talk about it.
Years ago, my dad shot a bear during the deer. This is back in the time when you could hunt during the deer season. And it was, of course, my dad was a meat cutter, and he, all the fat came off the bear, and then we used some little beef tallow around for the roast and stuff.
Yep.
The bear was very good.
Yeah, I agree. Bear can be very good, and you can treat it much like you do with deer and have sticks made and sausage, and you can also keep the hindquarters and have roasts and all sorts of options. So,
yeah, it was good, as I recall. Linda in Stevens Point. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good morning. Well, I'm hoping you can resolve a conflict my husband and I have every fall, in that I overwinter a lot of my plants and I bring them in without changing the dirt, and my husband swears I bring in mice every year. And I say that that's not possible. Mice would not be living in my pots. So, can you save us another year of marriage?
Well, what's on the line here? Do you have a friendly wager going over this?
Well, I'll take you out for a point beer when you're in the area.
Well, I even meant just between you and your husband. So.
Oh.
You should get a bet going with him.
Yeah.
Well, maybe. What do you say, Jamie?
Well, mice do not typically burrow. They'll build nests above ground, but they do not have the structure, the front feet, to be able to dig and be underneath the soil. So it's really unlikely that they're burrowing into those potted plants and overwintering in your house or coming out of your house because they were in the potted plant. And David?
Linda, I'm going to ask you a quick question, though. Have you or your husband actually seen a mouse in your potted plants in the house?
Never. We have mice in our house every fall, but have never seen any indication of them in my plant.
Okay, well, don't tell your husband this, but we're siding with you.
Yeah, and it's just a coincidental thing. Every fall, you bring in your potted plants, and every fall, the mice as David was talking about, are looking for a nice warm place to call home for the winter.
Yeah.
Well, I'm definitely going to tell him I was right, and now I have...
But right about this only, okay?
Coming from the man.
Thanks, Linda.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much for calling and for that question. We have a winner in our contest. So we should probably announce the winner. Actually, I don't know how many correct answers were there, Judith?
15.
15. There it is.
Wow, that's impressive.
So there were 15 correct answers. And so Judith did the drawing. And Joan B. in Green Bay. Joan, and then her first initial of her last name is B. She's from Green Bay, is the winner. And we will be sending her a copy of the book, Bird Sense, What It's Like to Be a Bird, by Tim Burkhead. And I'm going to play Let's play this once more, shouldn't we? Let's see here. All right, here's the bird song again. All right, and the bird is?
A Sora rail.
Sora rail.
So if I can talk briefly.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, the inspiration for this was I was just recently at the Horicon Marsh last weekend with my family, and we were just noting the beginning of the fall migration through Horicon. So a little plug for Horicon here and other state natural areas. Now is a really great time to get out and enjoy the migrating birds that are out there. So there were a couple Sora rails that we saw during the day, but also harriers. There were wood ducks, just absolutely beautiful. Mallards, lots of coot, pie-billed grebes, great egrets, sandhill cranes. And we didn't see one, but there were reports that there's been a whooping crane in the area at Horicon Marsh. Mm. And Horicon, actually, September 4th, just received 6 whooping crane chicks that are being cared for by staff in crane costumes. And those young will get released this fall to fly or migrate to Florida with older whooping cranes that have taken that journey before. So that work is being done at Horicon as well. But Horicon is a wonderful place to visit. And the Sora itself is a marsh bird, likes the cattails, and it's a relatively secret bird. So it's really important to learn that bird's song and being able to recognize it, because you often hear it and note that it is there rather than see it.
And again, the marsh is such a great place. There's great hiking and walking. I mean, there's and the building, the DNR building there, is a wonderful visitor center. And I believe there are still boats sort of tourists through the marsh.
Yeah, I think that's Blue Heron, I want to say, is the company. But yeah, there are opportunities to rent boats in that general area, or canoes and kayaks, or bring your own. But there are mm-hmm. water
and I think
trails.
There's some guided trails.
Absolutely.
Trips, yeah. So
lots of opportunity up there.
It is a great place to visit any time of the year, but the fall is just wonderful. Wow. You know, when the migratory waterfowl come in, they get hundreds of thousands of Canada geese alone on top of all the other waterfowl species. It's just a neat place.
I'll tell you, to be there on the highway right at dusk when those thousands and thousands and thousands of geese come in, it's just an unbelievable sight.
And loud.
And loud. You bet. Jeanette in La Crosse, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I just a quick note. I was listening actually to Minnesota Public Radio this morning, and they were talking about some people that do research with the bears and up in northern Minnesota, and there's one named June, and they have a tracking device on her, and they just tracked her down and put a bunch of bright things on her collar, so hopefully no one will shoot her.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to throw that out there just in case, so they can watch for her and don't kill her, because she's real sweet, and they go right up to her and they talk to her and can work with her, and she's real tame and well, relatively so. So just a side note, but the reason I call is I was wondering, I'm on the other spectrum as far as squirrels go, and I was wondering, I have 2 squirrel houses up, and I noticed that when they take the leaves and stuff up there, eventually it'll turn into dirt. And I was wondering what time of the year, or can I do it right now where there won't be any babies in there, that I can clean all that dirt out of there so I can get ready for winter for them? Do you have any idea?
Okay, Jamie?
Sure. Squirrels will actually have young, they can have multiple litters throughout the course of the spring and summer, but actually now is a pretty good time to do that. And if you're watching your houses, you kind of know whether those squirrels have left the nest box, but even between those nestings or litters, you can get in there and remove all of those leaves. And it's not necessarily dirt that's in there, but those leaves are starting to decay and break down, and it looks like just kind of a dirt pile. But you're right, and this would be a good time of the year where the young are out of the nest box now, and you can go in there and clean them out.
Mm-hmm. So you just kind of cross your fingers and stick your hand in there hoping it comes back?
Or wear a pair of leather gloves, knock on the outside of the box before you open it, things like that.
Yeah.
Oh, and can I ask one more real quick one?
Yeah.
Are there any more baby snapping turtles hatching yet this year, or are they done?
There could be. Turtles usually either breed right after they emerge from the winter, so early in the spring, or sometimes they'll breed late summer. And sometimes if you get some certain turtle species, The hatchlings will hatch out of the egg in the fall, but there's a glycol type substance, almost like antifreeze, is contained within that egg, and they'll actually overwinter in that egg, and that glycol substance keeps them from freezing, and then they'll emerge the following spring. So it is possible that you may still see some turtle eggs out there even at this time of the year.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Tom in Madison. Hi, Tom.
Hi. With the bird calls, that reminded me that I thought there was a researcher, was it Mark Barris? Is that how he pronounces his name?
Yeah.
That had the app, the bird identification app by Birdsong, and I was wondering what the status of that is. Is that out? Is it available? Or can you tell me more about that?
I just talked to Mark about this maybe a month ago because I heard a story on national NPR, and Mark had been interviewed for that story. And it's still in what's called beta testing, so he's still working the bugs out of it. The app is called WeBirds, for WI for Wisconsin Birds, and I think he's hoping to have it out by next spring for the birding season.
Yeah, so it's coming. I'm going to have to get him on the show just to talk about it because there's a lot of interest in that, and Judith's probably already got him lined up. And
yeah, I'm looking forward to it
fishing.
As well.
Judith's been talking to him, actually. We'll get him set up. We are having a lot of fun today talking with David Drake and Jamie Knack. David's a wildlife specialist with UW Extension, associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology. Jamie, a wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, both at UW-Madison. And they will be with us right up until 12:30 on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. So happy to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Many of us who live in Wisconsin count our amazing wildlife as one of our real treasures here in the state. And we're lucky to have David Drake and Jamie Knack as our guides today. They're both from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. And they're with us until 12:30 today and happy to answer your questions. Have you spotted an animal or a bird recently for the first time? Or maybe you're wondering where you might be able to see a particular animal or bird? Whatever your question, join in by calling us at 1-800-642-1234. Don't forget to visit our Facebook page where you can leave a question, a comment, even a wildlife photo. And then click like while you're there, and we'll send you regular updates on upcoming show topics. And we'll be back with our guests right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Lots of great information coming our way from two guests, Jamie Knack and David Drake, as we talk with them about our Wisconsin wildlife. Wildlife in this state, one of the wonderful things about living here, I think. And really, there's lots of activity around. It seems like every creature is really busy this time of the year. You may have some questions about those creatures, and I hope you'll call us or go to my Facebook page. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. Go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a question or a comment there. And Jackie in Milwaukee has been waiting a long time, so let's go right to Jackie. Hi, Jackie. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. Thank you. I wish I had $120 to spend on a feeder. Anyhow, and I'm not. That's not a comment, a bad comment. I've got two problems. One is choosing between housework and watching the birds and filling the feeders that are going through my backyard. The other question is someone gave me a bag of dry mealworms? What do you do with them?
Well, Jackie, the intention with those dried mealworms, and to be honest, I've tried them and my mom has tried them as well to attract bluebirds. So mealworms are a great source of protein and food for bluebirds. I thought, well, that's easier than buying live mealworms. I'll give that a try. And you're supposed to hydrate them in water before you put them out. However, do try them. And, you know, let us know how it works for you. I was just talking at a Master Gardener program last night and was asked this question about mealworms, and a woman was having lots of success. Bluebirds just in all over the yard right now.
Wow.
Eating.
Right now.
Eating mealworms, but she is feeding live mealworms. And she is getting them through catalog sources through the internet. And I asked her if she ever tried the dried mealworms, and she has, and she also did not have any luck with it. So do try it. You know, it's definitely worth the try if you already have them. But if that doesn't work, don't give up on mealworms, but look for a source of live mealworms to put out.
Well, I know where I can get a live one because
Great.
Someone that raises little critters feeds them to the little critters that they breed. But you said something about dehydrating them, putting them in water?
Yeah, I don't know if your package still has directions with it, but you are supposed to soak them in water to hydrate them.
There you go.
There's going to be something out there that'll eat them between the chipmunks and the squirrels that effectively dismantled one of those nice squirrel-proof things, broke the spring.
Oh, they broke the spring? Oh, my goodness.
Just be careful. I've been blaming the squirrels for eating the bottom out of the socks that I have that are filled with Niger seed. Yeah. And I found out it's some of the bigger birds, and they know enough to dig a hole or bite a hole in the bottom so everything pours out on the ground. It's interesting here. I'm going to go back. I don't know if I'm going to watch birds or do my housework.
Well, listen to us. Do your housework and listen to us. Thanks, Jackie.
Okay, dear. Bye-bye.
Bye. Appreciate it. Oh, Mark sent us a photo. He said, I rescued this injured bird earlier this week and got it to the Humane Society to be helped. I think it might be a sora. You can't see the feet in the photo, but they were very large and unwebbed. So obviously a marsh bird of some kind. Bird itself is robin-sized. I found it in the middle of an asphalt parking lot in West Dallas. Can you confirm or the ID and give a little more information about this species? I'm not familiar with it.
It certainly looks like a sora rail from that. The bird they kind of describe as a chicken-like type bird, and it's probably a little bit, sora rails typically are a little bit larger than robins as an adult, so this very well could be a young of the year or a sora rail that just hatched out this year, and they should be on their way south here either now or very shortly. They migrate out of our area for the wintertime. So unless you can find something, I guess you said you brought it to the Humane Society, but it is possible that this bird may be injured or it may just be malnourished on its flight south and maybe just stopped to rest and is looking for some more food to re-energize itself and continue further south. But certainly the Humane Society should be able to figure out what's going on with that bird and help it out.
Janice in Shiocton, hello to you. Are you there, Janice?
Hello, yes, I am. Thank you very much for this program.
Sure.
I have hummingbird questions. Is the hummingbird the only bird in this area that builds a nest with lichens, number one?
Oh, that's a tough question.
I doubt it.
It's probably not the only bird that utilizes lichens, and there's probably more avid birders listening to the program that can enlighten us with that as well. But they certainly do. Hummingbirds do use lichens to build their nest in a very small nest.
Yes,
indeed.
Well, I have a nest in a bluebird house that's covered with a trumpet vine. And I saw the hummingbirds go in there repeatedly one day. Do they use that nest again next year?
No, they won't use the same nest next year. They will build a new nest. But I have to say that's a pretty unusual or interesting observation.
Yeah, very cool.
They are not known to be a cavity nester. So that's pretty interesting.
That's what I thought. But when I peeked in there, there's lichens on top of fine grasses, and I've looked in every single bird book, including my nesting book, and they never tell you if they're going to use that nest again next year.
So
I think I'm going to leave it there.
The trumpet vine, the trumpet honeysuckle that you're talking about, that is certainly hummingbirds are feeding on that vine. I have the same situation at our house, and the hummingbirds are all over that. But you've actually seen the hummingbirds go into the birdhouse?
Not into the birdhouse, but in that area. They were back and forth and back and forth continuously.
So,
but this was a while ago, maybe last month.
Yeah,
or even before that.
I guess I'm still a little skeptical that that's a hummingbird nest. There's it's potential it could be a different species. They just are not typically a cavity nester, and you're seeing them around that nest box. I have a bluebird house on a trellis with the trumpet's honeysuckle all over it, and the hummingbirds are flying around the house, but certainly not going in it or nesting in it. But again, if you can open up that nest box and get a picture of the nest, and okay, put it on the Facebook page, we can maybe get some more clues out of the picture of that nest. But their nest is usually a very tightly kept nest,
yep, like
woven with lichens and really yep. small.
Yep. What other bird would build with lichens?
I don't know offhand without looking at a Peterson guide to bird nests and looking at that.
Can't help you out on that one.
Now, we'll take a picture and put it on your Facebook. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Someone at DNR says blue-gray gnat catchers.
Well, that's true. They will as well. That's right. I'm sure there are other bird species that are using lichens because it's relatively
For
available.
Sure. It's available.
Yeah. And it's a nesting material. But it's not. I'm not sure. I don't know that the majority of species are using lichens in their nest.
Right.
All right. Joby in Lake County, Illinois. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi there, how are you?
Good.
Good. I just have probably a really fast, easy-to-answer question. About a month ago, I was looking out my kitchen window at my bird feeders, and lo and behold, underneath my bird feeders, there was a bright red bird. And at first glance, I thought, that must be a cardinal. Well, I grabbed my binoculars, looked at it, and it wasn't a cardinal. But it looked a lot like a tanager. And living in northern Illinois, occasionally we see
scarlet tanagers, yeah.
But it didn't have black wings. And so when I looked at it through the binoculars, it was pretty much all red. It was more like a dappled red. And I did some research and thought maybe it was a summer tanager, but they're not supposed to be this far north in my state. So my question is, Hurricane Isaac had just blown through. Could that bird have been flown hundreds of miles off course into my backyard?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, David, are you...
Yeah, for sure. Summer tanagers are typically more of a southern United States bird than
right.
the scarlet tanagers are. So obviously scarlet tanagers we have up here in Wisconsin as well. As you mentioned, you have them in northern Illinois. But it's not uncommon for birds to get either blown off course or, you know, this was a very, very warm summer. And birds will sometimes take that opportunity to expand their range north or in areas where they typically are not found if the conditions are suitable. And that very well could have been the case as well.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Lucille in Luxembourg, you're next. Hi, Lucille.
Hi. My question is strange. It's about a bird that came to our feeders in early spring when I had a lot of suet and that out, and I have a very old bird book, and it looked exactly like a snowbird. It was here for 2 days, and I haven't seen it since. Do you know anything about snowbirds? It did say that they nest in Lower Canada.
Are you talking about snowy owls?
No, it's a bird.
Snow geese?
No, it's about the size of a blue jay, or it's all white with black wings. It looks like the shape of a robin.
Are you thinking snow bunting?
I don't know. In the book it said bird.
so look up snow bunting. B is in boy or bravo, U-N-T-I-N-G. And
okay.
See if that's the bird that you saw.
Okay. That's a good guess, for sure.
But that sounds, from the description, that sounds like it, and that's about a robin-sized bird.
Okay, then where do they nest, and where do they, any ideas?
I believe snow buntings go further north, and I'm not exactly sure where they nest specifically, but and then typically they would come into our area, I think, in the winter. I'm trying to think about their ecology.
Uh-huh.
I'll tell you what, if you find, if you either use a internet search engine and type snow bunting in there, You should get both a picture, but you should also get a bunch of information on their life history and ecology, and that will be a lot more information than I can give you off the top of my head right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, Jamie, do you have anything to add to that?
Not really. The All About Birds website from Cornell Lab of Ornithology is a great online guide.
Wonderful.
Fantastic.
Thanks, Lucille. Appreciate your call. We've got a Facebook question from Kevin. And we talked about Horicon Marsh as a really great place to view animals. But he's wondering what kinds of fun animal events we can look forward to this fall. The goose and bird migration is always enjoyable. Any others to keep an eye out for? You got anything going, David?
Well, there's all sorts of stuff. Obviously, the migration of the birds is a big one right now. Certainly, animals that are going to stay here for the winter are fattening up as much as they can to get some fat reserves on and increase their size to the extent possible to survive the winter. When I daily bike ride into work, I'm now seeing squirrels with walnuts and things in their mouths, so they're getting ready for that. Animals are starting to nest. If you're, for example, a bear or woodchuck or something like that, that's a hibernatory animal, they're starting to get ready for hibernation. And so not all of these things may be readily evident to see, but they are going on every year. And the big trigger for this is day length. As day length reduces, there's a lot of other events that go along with that. So colder temperatures, different precipitation changes and things like that. And all of those are cues to the animals to either get the heck out of here if you're going south or get ready to survive the winter, however your strategy is.
We have Sam Thayer, the forager, who we've had on the show, commented regarding wood turtles. Wood turtles, he said, are much larger than painted turtles. While 18 inches is large, doesn't seem unbelievable to him. 9 inches is about the minimum size for an adult, not the maximum. The typical adults by size are 2 to 5 times the mass of a typical adult painted turtle. From the caller's description, it seems certain that the turtle he found was a wood turtle.
Wood turtles are pretty distinct animals, and one of the reasons they call them wood turtles is because if you look at the scuter, those individual panels on the turtle shell, it looks like the rings that you would see if you were to cross-cut across a log, for example. And so turtles, one of the things that they do as they grow is that they'll shed those scutes and grow new ones. But wood turtles, instead of shedding them, they actually add a ring to their scute. So you can actually count how old that wood turtle is by counting the number of rings in each scute. And that's why they're called wood turtles. And they are pretty distinct turtles. So I would think for the caller who had the question about wood turtles, if he was able to either find a picture of a wood turtle on the internet or in a field guide, that certainly that would be a pretty good matchup if he can recall in his mind what that turtle looked like.
Sarah in Zion, Illinois, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I was sitting there eating lunch just now, and I heard a big bump, and sure enough, a bird had just died on my window. But anyway, so the thing is, I've lived here for a long time, and I've never had a bird fly into this window. And I live in an apartment building, and I found the same breed of species in front of somebody else's window the other day. And I'm just wondering what it is, and, like, do some birds, like, have more of a tendency to fly into windows than others? It's this little, it's a little bit bigger than a chickadee. It's got a greenish-gray, got a black stripe over its eye and kind of a long beak. Any idea?
Well, I'm not sure we'll get to the identification there, but I think with the time we have, we should talk a little bit about reducing window collisions, and now is the time to give some attention to that as birds are migrating. There's a number of different reasons why a bird flies into a window, and it either has to do with the reflectivity of the window. In other words, they're seeing the landscape, the trees, and the sky reflecting in the window and don't realize that there's actually an impenetrable object there, or they have in a building, an office building, a home, where the windows on one side of the home line up with a set of windows on the other side, and the birds actually see through the house, essentially, to the habitat on the other side of that building or home, and think that they can just pass right on through and end up colliding. Or they're feeding at a bird feeder, and a sharp-shin hawk or a cat or some other type of predator comes into view, and they flee, and in the panic of fleeing, they fly into the window. So there are lots of great tips for how to reduce window collisions. You said this is the first time you've seen it, and hopefully that will, you know, it won't be a common occurrence. But if it does get to that point, you can put silhouettes that you can purchase that adhere to the window to break up that outline. You can plant a trees or shrubs in front of the window or near the window to, again, break up the reflection. During particularly sensitive times of the year, you can hang a compact disc or Mylar tape or, again, something in front of the window to break up the reflection and cause some movement to let the birds know that, you know, it is, in fact, a window present. There's lots of great tips, and, again, those are outlined in a number of different birding websites like Cornell Lab of Ornithology and other sources.
Yep.
Okay.
Thanks, Sarah. Thanks a lot for calling. Jeff in Hub City. Hi.
Hi there. I was down working in Dane County on Monday, and I was having lunch at the Westport Town Hall, sort of on the north side of Lake Mendota. And on the soccer fields, there was a large amount of sandhill cranes. And all of a sudden, three, I would say, whitish to grayish white birds, and they did have a little bit of black on them. Three of them came down and landed, and they were literally head and shoulders taller than the sandhills. And I've worked in the area a long time and just never seen a bird like that. And I wondered if you knew what I might have seen. And they took off before I could get a photo of them.
Well, there's got to be another crane.
It certainly could. And you know, certainly the whooping cranes are moving through right now. So it's possible that they are whooping cranes. Although I think that whooping cranes, we have an experimental population of whooping cranes here in Wisconsin. And I think those whooping cranes are pretty closely monitored. So you might be able to find somebody with that experimental population and call them and see if they were able to identify, were they in the Westport area on the day you saw them. But
yeah, and they didn't stick around long. I was digging through my briefcase for my phone, and by the time I looked up again, they had moved on, and I watched for quite a while to see if I just lost them among the sandhills, but they were gone.
The hoopers they're bigger than the sandhills.
They are, and did you see them fly by any chance?
Yeah, I mean, they came in and landed, and everything about them was, they were like sandhills, but they were noticeably bigger.
Yeah, because when they fly, the identifying characteristic of whooping cranes is they're primarily an all-white bird, but they have black wingtips.
Yeah.
As you look up from underneath.
That's kind of what I saw, but I couldn't believe that I actually had seen one of those or that it was possible. But,
well, that's pretty neat. Well, consider yourself lucky.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Appreciate the call very much. That's a very, very, very cool sighting. Well, we've got a question from Lisa. How do I deter chipmunks? They have dug little tunnels next to our house, hide in a window well quite often.
Well, there's lots of different options on the table to dealing with chipmunks, and they can be from trying to exclude them from the area to lethal control, buying a rat trap and baiting it with some peanut butter and putting it near the hole. You can certainly remove chipmunks pretty efficiently that way. And you do want to be careful about their tunnels near foundations, near your rock walls, retaining walls, sidewalks, driveways. They can undermine enough soil to cause some pretty severe damage to the infrastructure there. So, and also with the window well, that's sort of an easy solution. You can put a cover on the window wells. Those are pretty readily available at home supply stores and so on. So you can cover the window well. That's a good idea in general in terms of wildlife. Toads can get trapped in there, shrews. We pulled a possum out of a window well here on campus a few years back. So you might want to go ahead and cover that to begin with. And then as far as the tunnels, there are ways that you can either, again, trap them or deter them. In some cases, you can exclude them using hardware cloth in the area.
We had many callers, including Noel Cutright, calling in on the bird nesting in the bluebird box is undoubtedly a black-capped chickadee.
Great. Thanks, Noel.
Yeah, that makes a whole lot of sense. And I just haven't quite found it here, but there's a wood turtle photo on the Facebook page. And just as I'm trying to kind of maneuver around to find it, but it's there. And so you have a chance, if you're wondering what a wood turtle looks like, there is a nice photo on the Facebook page.
I think I see it. It's just to the left of, go up to the top, Larry. It's just to the left of the 4,246 people that like you.
Oh. Oh.
It's under photos there. Is that right?
Is that it there? All right, maybe it is. There it is.
Yep, that's it.
Yep, there it is. Wow. Very cool. Very cool. And you guys are cool, too. Thanks, David. Thanks, Jamie. Appreciate it very much. And, well, you guys will come back, I hope.
Yeah, we'd love to.
Anytime we're invited.
All right, great. David Drake, wildlife specialist with UW Extension, associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. Jamie Knack, wildlife outreach specialist in the DNR. I'm sorry, not the DNR, the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. At the UW-Madison. Oh, my goodness. I didn't want to. That was a big mistake. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.